So I'm Farai Chidea, and I'm a friend of Tanya's and Jay's, and also a fan of Samuel Delaney, who goes by Chip, so I will address you as Chip. And what can I say? I'm a reporter, but I'm also a huge speculative fiction and science fiction fan. And unfortunately, I have not read Dahlgren. I've read some of your other novels, so I will not even front. I will not even pretend. I've read small excerpts. I have not...
Yeah, it's very long.
I mean, I was just reading an excerpt of the beginning, and there was just an image of holding coffee in your mouth that stuck with me. And the way that you play with sensuality in your work, as well as with ideas, I'm a big Twitter person these days, and when I was announcing that this play was being staged, someone said, "It is impossible, impossible to adapt Dahlgren for the stage." So, what do you think now that you've seen it adapted? Is it possible, Chip?
I think that this was an extraordinary job. I really, really do, Jay. When people as creative and smart as you and Tanya get a hold of something like that, it's a very humbling experience. I recognized almost everything in the everything, and that was quite a warming experience. I would imagine that the people, those in the audience who have read the book, probably recognized a good deal of it as well. And so, what can I say? Except my overwhelming feeling is just one of thank you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to go to something very specific in the play that is a very basic difference between the play and the book. And in the words of Mrs. Richards, I thought they were sending a man. So Jay, why was Kid, who was played by Sarita, a woman and not a man? How did you get to that casting decision?
I guess there are probably two parts to the answer to that. You make a decision and then you figure out why. Then you find a way to like support it. So part of it was just about wanting to work with Sarita. Mm-hmm. It's actually that simple, in a way. The other half of the idea comes from at the very end of the novel, as Kid is leaving the city, they meet somebody else who's on her way in, and it's a woman. I think, if I get the word right, an Asian woman is on her way into the city, someone coming from the east. And so, for us, because when Kid arrives, Kid finds a notebook, and part of the book is already written, so to speak, and then adds more to it. And we just sort of thought, well, we're going to try to make the third. We're making the third sweep through, through an event that has already happened, but seems to be coming again, or seems to be about something's already happened, but it's also about to happen.
Well,
it's very close to the book. I mean, this is something that comes directly out of the book. Kid himself is half American Indian, and the person that he meets when he leaves in the book is an Asian woman, an indeterminately Asian woman, and there are lots of references to things that could have happened to her as well all through the book. So I think it was a very familiar. Even though it was a new story in many ways, which I like because I'm seeing something new, but at the same time I'm seeing something that's very much inscribed in the novel itself.
Again, from Twitter, I feel like I'm channeling voices unseen and unheard. But on Twitter, someone said, "Well, isn't this just taking away the male on male sexuality and sensuality of the play?" I mean, someone asked that question. And I want to get both of your perspectives. Were you afraid that it would change the work in a way that changed the sexual structure of the work?
Sure, definitely. And it, our first workshop, the first, so we've taken a few swings at this, and the first workshop kid was a guy, and so there were a lot of, you know, really hot guy scenes, like, you
there's
know,
still plenty tons of guys.
We still have a couple got hot guy scenes from that workshop, but yeah, of course, definitely. I mean, it's like a huge theme, and it's a really rich theme, and we tried like switching lots of genders at first, like, well, okay, we'll just switch them all, and then it's you know, not guy on guy, but girl on girl, and that didn't always feel like the right idea, and so, you know, we just keep switching it.
I was interested, the person who, you know, again, from Twitterlandia, saw it as a political decision, like, was asking the question, was this done to make it more palatable? And I was just like, if you had seen his play, you would not be talking about more palatable. but you know, how has your work, Chip, been filtered through layers of politics? And do you write to provoke? Do you write to frame imagination? How do you think about politics as you send an intent as a writer and then as people interpret?
How do I think about politics? Obsessively and all the time. I'm very concerned about the political statements that are implied in certain relationships and how they are seen by most people. And in one sense, the entire novel is a commentary on the usual way in which those relationships are seen. And this means that it's a very tricky thing to do, to reverse genders and to change the gender content of a scene. And yes, was I worried? I was terrified that it wasn't going to be my vision at all. I'm surprised at how much, at what a large percent of it really does work, which I think is a tribute to Jay and Tanya and the actors. Extraordinary intelligence and sensitivity. All of you guys are just amazing. What is Natalie's last name?
Thomas.
Natalie Thomas, you know, John and Sarita, and I mean everybody. I Hammond and the whole. I feel like I'm here at Oscar night, you know, and I'm forgetting all the people who are supposed to say thank you to. But you guys have done again an amazingly good job of you know bringing the nuances of what is going on. And this is the second time, this is the third time I've actually seen a run through. Two times I've seen performances, and then once I saw a rehearsal. And this is certainly the one that I think works the best for me. It's been also an interesting experience to see the thing clarify each time I come to it. You were saying that you had seen an earlier production too and had much the same feeling.
Exactly.
You guys are very lucky that you came tonight.
Well, you know, it's the physicality of the space and the design, which is, you know, so much a part of what you do as a director and someone who collaborates. I was there the night that there was the little preview in the Worcester Group space.
Uh-huh.
And then when I came the first time on opening night, I was sitting over here, and the video was not such a big presence for me, and my sight lines on the action in this space were in some ways more direct from over there. And then sitting here, the video was more of a presence for me, and my sight lines in some ways were more blocked. So, you know, if you think about the number of performances you've had of this play and the number of seats here, probably nobody saw the same thing. Was that intentional?
Yeah, very, very much so. That you could actually sit in a different place and enter and really have a very different experience. But hopefully, like every, all of them have their own advantages, and they all deliver us maybe a slightly different perspective, but the same general idea, you know, generally.
And how do you work? And I'm going to ask this of both of you, but I'm going to start with you, Jay. How do you work in terms of putting together, you know, the concept, putting together a team of actors, putting together a team of people who help create the visual aesthetic? And what's your process?
Really backwards in a lot of ways. Like, I'll try to put together an ensemble first, actually even before knowing what the roles are, right? So the adaptation of this is actually really made for the people who are in the room, and they take part in making it. So, you know, we're definitely improvising with a lot of texts. Things are rewritten sort of on the fly by the performers live and on camera, but redone live. I'm sure you heard a lot of new text tonight.
Yes, I did.
and actually, the truth is, like, that happens every night. Right, but it's that because we try to stay loose with some of the syntax and really specific where the language is really specific. But you know, in the process, we start out a year or so in advance, and we start talking and getting the people in the room. We try to meet two or three times for a week or 10 days to work on ideas, throw things, sort of throw paint at the wall, and look for a shape.
And Chip, as a writer, what is your process? I mean, you know, I've written books as well, mainly nonfiction, but I tend to write in like sprints. Mm-hmm. Some people are, you know, a page a day is a book a year, or some variation thereof. On a very basic level, how do you write? But also, how does it change you to write? Are you always writing, or do you have periods where you're not writing?
I think I am always writing, basically. I think of myself as the world's laziest writer. A couple of times ago when I was having a conversation about this, and my daughter, who has just graduated from medical school, and I am a proud, proud father of a doctor now. At any rate, she was sort of sitting there, and I was saying, well, I'm this really lazy guy. I mean, I spent a lot of time just sort of, you know, sitting there not doing anything, staring. And she said, Dad, she says, come on, you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. You get you have a cup of coffee and you get started working, and then you work all day, and then about 9 o'clock you collapse, and then you do the same thing the next day and the next day. I would say you work harder than anybody I've ever seen do anything. And I said, is that what hard work is? You know, and I said, quite honestly, I just, you know, that feels to me like total laziness. I do remember once having a job in an office when I had, you know, back in the middle 80s. I used to get there an hour and a half before anybody else got there. And I thought, wow, this is so easy. People who come in, you know, I'd get there at 7 o'clock, 7:30 in the morning, you know, while other people drifted in at 9:30 and 10, you know. And I would get home and I'd have enough energy to help the kid with the homework. You know, and I thought, gee, if I'd known that the real world was as easy as this, I might have tried it out. You know, because it doesn't take quite as much energy. I don't know. It's, as I said, I feel lazy. I feel like a lazy bum. But I, you know, obviously something gets done in the midst of all of this staring at the wall. You know.
And who are the people in your novels? Are they? What I mean by this is, when you're writing, do they seem like companions? Do they seem like people who are bugging you to tell their story and they won't shut up until you do? Who are they to you as you're in the process?
Well, they tend to be, the people I write about tend to, there. I have sort of two criteria for people I write about. I want to write about people doing things that I have done myself, you know, so I will know what it feels like to do those things, and I will know what it feels like from the inside. But I also want to write about people whom I have watched do the same things, so I know what it looks like from the outside. So there's kind of a limit, the intersection of the two, people I have watched do certain things and people, you know, who do things that I've done myself, so that I have both the subjective and the objective, point of view about both. And it's, you know, it's been holding, you know, it's been serving me in fairly good stead for the last 45 years. And hope it will for another, you know, for another handful. So that's about all I can really say.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Hey, I have a question.
Yes, please.
So we added these two words, speculative fiction, tonight.
Yeah, correct me.
And I've thought about this a lot, but I'm curious about science fiction versus speculative fiction.
I cringed.
I thought.
No, I didn't.
Can't win them all.
And it's okay. I mean, it's perfectly fine. You know, speculative fiction is not a term that I use. I think it's kind of an inflated term that academics use. It means the science fiction that they happen to approve of. It was a useful term for about 4 years, from about 1968 to 1972, and I did use it during those 4 years, and I haven't used it since.
People
use it in various and sundry ways, I am not against. One of the things that's a big part of my aesthetic, there are no words that I'm against as words. I don't think there's anything wrong with the N-word. I don't think there's anything wrong with the F-word. I don't even think there's anything wrong with speculative fiction. Right. There are ways to use all of them. And people do.
Yeah, this one's history, though.
It's a historical term. Yeah. It locks the thing into into the early 70s.
So yeah. With Dahlgren, Dahlgren, I think sort of, I had a hard time describing it as science fiction when people had asked me.
It
why
is
it science fiction.
Fiction. No.
Of course. So this is my question.
I'm pulling your leg, Jim.
I would put it on the shelf next to Dostoevsky, or I would put it on the shelf next to these sort of a much different kind of writing, or literature, whatever book. It's a big book, but science fiction. Do you mind talking about what science fiction, how you landed in science fiction?
I read a lot of it as a kid and enjoyed it muchly. Some of the most emotional reading experiences that I had came to me through science fiction. And so when I started writing, I wanted just to write novels. I've told the story many, many times. My then wife was working as an editor at a company, Ace Books, that published science fiction novels, and she would come home and complain about the science fiction novels that she had to edit. And so I began to write a novel that was basically just for her. It changed some of the things that, you know, it dealt with some of the problems that she was complaining about. And after I was about halfway through, she said, you know, and she would read it, and she said, you know, this is not half bad. You should submit it. And I said, oh, come on, you know. And she said, no, you really should. So we submitted it under a pen name, Bruno Calabro. Where I got that, I will never know. She brought it in, and one of her monthly jobs was to read the slush pile, and the slush pile was the pile of unsolicited manuscripts that came in, and if she found anything interesting, she was supposed to point it out to the editor-in-chief, the late and wonderful Don Walheim, whose daughter Betsy Walheim now edits Daw Books. She handed it to Don and said, oh, well, I found this in the slush pile. It was fairly interesting. Take a look at it. So Don read it, and he liked it. And so he drew up contracts. And only after the contracts were drawn up, we had a discussion the night. And then she said she went in the next day and confessed, "That's my husband." So Don said, "Thank God, because I hate the name Bruno Calabro." And so I went back to being Samuel Delaney. That's how I got started. You know, and since after I'd written one, I decided to write another one, and then another one, and then another one, and then number 10 was 879 pages, and 35 years ago, here it is tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to go to questions after this question. I know we don't have an unlimited amount of time, and you know, but I did want, since you said there's no words that are off limits.
Mm-hmm.
Including the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
Nigger is invoked in this play.
Right.
And there's another play, which I can't remember the name of, that was criticized in the New Yorker for being racist. Can anyone help me out? It's on stage right now.
Was it written in America?
No.
Oh, well then, there you go.
No, it's the...
what was it?
Yes, Behanding in Spokane. Uh-huh. It was just, I have not seen that play. I want to see it. But it seems to me that the use of the language seemed uncontroversial in a certain way to me. I don't know how
I
you...
Don't know, I don't know the play. So.
No, in tonight's play.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm just curious. Like, was anyone disturbed by the use of the word nigger in the play? I guess that's an unfair question of an audience. I mean, it strikes me that you know there's a fair amount of mean-spiritedness, sexual violence, and racial tension exhibited by characters in this play. And some of it provokes laughs.
Mm-hmm.
How do you appropriately use laughter, Jay, as a director, when you're dealing with subjects like this?
By trying to go over the top far enough that, like, the funny things stay funny and the difficult pieces, the difficult, more sort of philosophical problems, things you have to think about a little further, become accessible.
Yeah, I think laughter can diffuse a certain orders of anxiety. Not all,
mm-hmm.
you know. And sometimes one of the and something can something that laughter used to diffuse things that it shouldn't diffuse produces more anxiety. You know, so certainly. Mm-hmm. But I think it can work the other way around. And I think I'm still very fond of the exchange between Tack and Fenster. I think, you know, I liked it when I wrote it, and I like it when I like the way it sounds on from the stage, and the audience seems to find it, you know, seems to respond to it kind of the way I wrote it. So yeah.
It's like, you know, watching a disillusioned white supremacist sort of falling in love with a, you know, a great activist. I think it's funny.
Yeah.
It's funny and it's interesting. And they're talking about it so openly.
Yeah.
I think, like, people actually, like, talking and making jokes about their problems in a really intense way. That's pretty much science fiction in some way.
Yeah.
Well, I will go to a few. I mean, do we have a mechanism for questions, or are folks going to yell them out, or people can bribe me?
Right.
Now, I see someone raising their hand. Yeah.
Hi. I tried over a period of many years to read Dahlgren a few times, and I threw it at the wall absolutely the first few times, and I said, "This is ridiculous." And I found it, to use a word you just used, I found it completely inaccessible. And then someone actually came to my house with, like, this flea market find, and it was a copy of Motion of Light and Water. And after getting through that and sort of understanding your thoughts and ideas about time and memory and just little moments and vignettes that you speak to that echo themselves in Dahlgren, the text just opened up for me, and I just fell in love. And people always ask me, well, oh, yeah, that book, Dahlgren? How'd you read that? How'd you get through it? And that's obviously just my answer. How would you tell people to get Dahlgren? How would you decide it in a way?
Well, I think it is wrong of the writer to try to bully the audience into reading his own book. I really do.
I'll do it.
No, quite honestly, I mean, which is to say, as far as I'm concerned, what people ask questions like that, I say, pick it up, read a page at random. If you want to read another one, go on and read it. If you don't, close it, put it down, and go on and do something else. I mean, I think that's the only thing that the writer can say, isn't some kind of, some sort of version of advertising hype. And God knows we are inundated with enough of that. And I don't want to add to that. It's just not what I'm about. There's nothing I can say. If you've read it and you liked it, I am very grateful. If you read it and you didn't like it, okay, that is absolutely your right.
But it sounds like what you're saying is there are gateway drugs that will lead you to die.
It wasn't that I didn't like it, it was that I just completely had no way to recognize what was going on. Mm-hmm. And then something opened a door for me and I was able to appreciate the text. And people often ask me, well, how did you even, how do you get there? It's so strange when you first start.
Well, I'm going to take two more questions and then we'll wrap up for the night.
A couple years ago, 5 years ago or something, this disaster happened in the South, and I remember writing something online about, could this be Dahlgren? Could this transform? And this is for both of you. When I read Dahlgren, I was traveling back and forth across the country, and I remember coming up out of subways in San Francisco and New York and being like, how do these people not know that the world's over already? Because I was so engrossed and lost in the text. Seeing this show tonight reminded me that I kind of, because I wanted New Orleans to become Dahlgren, because I want this kind of freedom and chaos to exist. And one of my friends responded to that saying that Dahlgren is a porn novel. Mm-hmm. A porn fantasy, and to accuse inflicting that on reality was such a horrible thing to even think. And things that are happening in Baghdad right now and in Africa, where there is chaos cities where people are living in utter chaos constantly. There's still a part of me that seeing this, I want this kind of racist artist faggot war zone reality to exist somewhere. Mm-hmm. That's accessible. Well, is that why you're bringing this? You're keeping it alive.
Well, Dahlgren is a porn novel, which is many people have said over the 35 years that the book has been out. Dahlgren in its first edition was 879 pages long. And after about the first 5 or 6 years, when people were talking about this amazing porn novel that just is either so awful or so great, and people were on both sides of the fence, and it's just dripping with sex from the very first page to the last page. So I counted. I went back and I thought, well, let me count how many pages in the text actually deal with sex. There are 36 pages. Out of 879 pages that deal with sex. This is pretty poor, money. This is a pretty poor shot for a porn novel. You want a little bit more sex than that, I would imagine, in a porn novel. So I don't think it stands up terribly. I have nothing against people calling it a porn novel, but I'm a little surprised at people calling it a good porn novel. That's the thing that seems a little odd. Because it's just, there just isn't enough sex in it. There really, really isn't. And indeed,
but the sex is really good.
What?
Yeah, well,
there you go. Maybe you're right. I don't know. But the point is, I think that one of the things that probably bothered me the most on the second time that I saw it, and I will say, everyone, there are some things, as I said, overall, I think this is an extraordinary, piece of work that you're done, but I was surprised that somehow it seemed like about 845 pages of the book had been sort of cut out, you know. And that's, you know, that was interesting to see, you know, to see that. And I sort of wondered why it was like that. I don't feel that about this version, about the version I saw. Now it seems to have gotten its proportions back, which I really like very, very much. So that was just an interesting way, you know, an interesting thing about it. You know, I don't know whether, did you feel in the two...
Well, see, not having read the novel, I noticed certain, you know, for example, when I saw it on opening night, the character who is pregnant, just, you know, like in that opening sequence, the chair was pulled out from under her, which is a very, I mean, it's like the ultimate mean-spiritedness to pull repeatedly pull a chair away from a pregnant woman. And I'm wondering, did you cut that for time? Did you cut it because you thought it was irrelevant or too mean-spirited?
I cut it because I felt like it was such a huge gesture that it was making it impossible to pay attention to the next six sentences, actually. Mm-hmm. And so getting rid of that little thing actually does make it possible to concentrate. It makes the story launch quicker. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, in the novel, we see one pregnant person, which has really caught my attention. And she and somebody throws a can of beans at her, I think. And I thought, my God, like, what an unbelievable... It's one of those sort of images that you can't actually fathom. And so we felt that it's too hard to throw a full can of beans at somebody in the theater. I mean, that could be kind of dangerous. We would try that, probably, because that's the kind of people we are, but bad idea.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about, the medical insurance for this entire production.
We have it. But pulling a chair up from under, you know, first we throw an empty can at her and he says, oh, Gladys, man, don't throw a can at her, she's pregnant. Come here, sit down. And then as she sits, he pulls the chair out from under her and she falls on the floor, which we actually thought it would be funny.
Jay, you're a strange man, Jay Shod.
Well, I mean, but in rehearsal, we all laughed because it was like, you know, I mean, they do crazy stuff on The Simpsons, everybody laughs. But it was not funny. And so we
I'm going to go to the last question over here.
Thank you very much, but alas, there's one novel is under option, and for every movie that gets made, there are 500 works under option, you know, that never see the screen, and so I suspect mine will be one of the 149 or one of the 499.
Which story is it?
Nova.
Any final thoughts, Jay?
One thing that was most interesting to me in the novel I put out a lot of rhetorical energy into never having the readers see any of Kid's poetry at all. Mm-hmm. You never see a phrase or a line or even a word that Kid actually writes. And anything that he does, you know, that does get into the notebook, very quickly you hear that either that page is destroyed, or he crosses it out, or, you know, or it's obliterated, so, or he rewrites it so you never, you know. And here, a lot of the internal stuff becomes the poetry itself, which is an interesting an interesting thing to you know to watch that happen. I actually rather enjoyed it. Yeah.
You haven't been voted off the island.
No, I mean we love the poetry. The poetry in the book is so fantastic, and finding a way to deal with it is something that we were really interested.
But it's not in the book. It's not poetry. It's very definitely prose. Prose I worked very hard at, but prose nevertheless. Yeah.
Well, this has been extraordinary. I know that there are more questions, but I also know that it's 10:30 at night. So I will just say thank you. Thank you so much, Chip. Thank you, Jay. Thank you to the cast.
And thank all of you
and
for
the crew.
Coming.
Thank you very much, and thank you everyone for coming.